Luis shot a sideways glance at Franco, and I wondered if I was one of the few outside of the Hijos circle who knew the Bonetti's history.
Are you interested in being a director or writer?
I asked.
Not sure yet.
He just won a screenwriting competition,
Franco said, bringing the hot drinks over to us.
Isn't that right, little brother?
That's great, I said. Congratulations.
And he's getting gigs all the time now as a freelance cameraman. He's been on a shoot, and we haven't seen each other in days.
Franco tried to pat his brother's head, but Luis ducked out from under his hand. Luis's hair was cut so short that his scalp was visible in spots. Unlike Franco, whose build was small and wiry, Luis had a stocky frame.
And you?
I'm from New York. I study at a college not far from there, I answered.
So you don't live here?
No, just visiting.
New York, eh?
Nice, Luis replied, but his tone let me know he was not impressed.
It's home, I said with a forced smile.
I drank the coffee as the brothers talked, and when I finished, I stood up. Grabbing my coat off the back of the chairs, I said,
I should get going. Nice meeting you, Luis.
Likewise,
Luis answered. He stood and gave me the customary kiss on the cheek. Franco walked me to the door and said in a low voice,
Hey, sorry about Luis. I should have said something to you before. I forget that he's reserved around people he doesn't know, and, well, he can be kind of a grouch sometimes. But once you get to know him, he's a real softy.
No problem.
Maybe he doesn't like the idea of his brother spending time with a Yankee.
Franco smiled at this.
Luis knows better than to meddle in my affairs, especially if they're of the romantic variety.
He brushed the bangs away from my eyes.
I'll see you tomorrow. I'll let you know what I find out. Yes?
I nodded. He rounded my waist with his arms and softly kissed me goodbye. A damp chill was in the air, the sky a ceiling of dark clouds, but I wanted to walk back to my grandfather's apartment. It would take me about an hour, and I had no other plans. My cell phone rang. It was Mom.
Paloma?
Mama? Hi.
Where are you? I hear traffic in the background.
I'm outside.
Are you on your way to the campo?
No, I'm not. Abuelo told you I called, right?
Yes, but he couldn't remember when you were coming back. We miss you.
It had been 3 days since I last saw my parents. I bit my cheek.
Juan invited me to visit his family's farm, and I said I would go.
Okay,
Mom responded, her voice disappointed if not frustrated.
I was calling you because we've all been invited to stay with friends for their annual cattle auction. They're throwing a big party. We'll spend a couple of nights.
In the campo life, going to visit a neighbor's ranch could easily mean a few hours' drive. Guests usually stayed overnight.
But I understand if you want to be with Juan. I'll tell your father.
Thanks, Mama. I'll see you at the ceremony then?
Yes.
I heard something in her tone when we were saying our goodbyes. Did she suspect I was actively avoiding them? I didn't like deceiving them, and I reassured myself it wouldn't be for much longer. I was curious to hear what Franco would find out from the woman we met at the hospital, but it was also true that the more time we spent together, the more I was drawn to him and his world. I was caught up in these thoughts when it started to rain. Should I take a bus? What line would get me back? Buenos Aires had a subway system, but I had no idea if there was a stop nearby. A car sprayed my ankles with rainwater. A few cabs went by, all occupied. I cursed under my breath. As the rain began to come down hard, I finally hailed one. The driver reached back to open the door and I climbed in. I looked down at my soaked pants and thought that as soon as I was home, I would pour myself a glass of wine and indulge in a long, hot bath. The cab sped through an intersection as the light turned red, and I realized that I was not holding on to the door handle, like I had when I first arrived in Buenos Aires. As we raced down the avenue toward the apartment, the city was one big wet blur. The rain subsided by the time the cab pulled up in front of Abuelo's building. I rummaged through my purse for my wallet.
Miss, are you in some sort of trouble?
No. Why do you ask? The driver looked at me in the rearview mirror.
A car without license plates has been following us.
What?
I glanced out the back window. They're not behind us anymore. He flicked his hand toward the passenger side. Over there, in the Ford Falcon.
I made out three people. Two in the front, one in the back. They must be picking someone up, I suggested uncertainly. The cabbie, nevertheless, waited until I was inside. I kept myself out of view until I had enough courage to look through the lobby's glass door. The car was still across the street. The driver, a bald man, was staring at my building and caught my eye. And then he, too, moved on.
Chapter 32, February 1976. The wedding for General Delgado's daughter, Mercedes, was celebrated in the lavish ballroom of the Alvear Palace, a hotel built in the 1930s by a socialite who had wanted to import Parisian Belle Époque grandeur to the Paris of the Americas. Guests clustered around the bride and groom, congratulating them on their union. Santiago placed his hand absently on his wife's back. Lila's emerald gown accentuated the deep green of her eyes, and her blonde hair shimmered under the chandelier. She would be a vision if not for her pout. When, earlier that evening, Lila had examined herself in their bedroom mirror, he had reassured her that she was at her most beautiful. But now, he had little patience for her sulking.
I love the flowers, Santiago's mother gushed to General Delgado's wife. And your dress. Everything is divine.
Not so long ago, it was you standing here in my shoes, Constanza, the mother of the bride replied, gesturing to Santiago and Lila. When Valentina had been in the picture, Constanza had tried to steer Santiago toward Mercedes Delgado.
Everything worked out fine, she thought, glancing at her son and daughter-in-law. Lila was a perfect wife for her son. The whole family adored her.
Alfonso Larrea shook the general's hand warmly. The military's first attempt to remove Isabel Perón from office in December had failed, but it was a new year, and whispers about another impending coup swirled about the ballroom. The weeks seemed to be numbered for the president.
Your men are doing a great job. The longer Isabelita stays in power, the worse off this country will be, Alfonso said. Between you and me, it's all lining up. We have a lot of work ahead of us to put this country back on track, the general told him in a confidential tone.
After wishing the couple many years of wedded bliss, Lila turned to Santiago and told him that she had to use the ladies' room. Glad to have an unexpected moment alone, Santiago's eyes swept the room, projecting a smile to the crowd. Grace was by the piano, where a small semicircle of people had formed. He joined the group, nodding amiably at a couple of guests. Once he was face to face with Grace, however, he dropped his smile just long enough for her to notice.
Are you all right? Grace asked.
He leaned over her ear. By his facial expression, a guest would assume he was relaying a humorous wedding day anecdote, but his voice, largely drowned out by the piano music, was more serious.
It's Valentina. She won't see me. She ended it 2 months ago.
A waiter approached with a tray of champagne flutes, and Grace took two.
Drink,
she recommended, handing one to Santiago.
I don't get it, Grace. Why does she keep breaking my heart?
In his rush to toss back the champagne, Santiago bumped a nearby guest and spilled the bubbly, mostly on himself, but also on the floor. The pianist glanced over without missing a note.
Pull yourself together, Grace said. She raised her glass toward a few surrounding onlookers who noticed the commotion. You're married. Don't forget that, she whispered in his ear. What you had with Valentina was an affair. And affairs always come to an end. Always. Besides, I could have told you she wouldn't leave Maximo. He winced.
Do you have to bring him up?
You really are still a child, she said, finishing her champagne.
You know him, Grace. He's not the kind of man you spend the rest of your life with.
She frowned. Santiago, he's still your friend.
I'm getting another drink. Can I get you one?
He asked, not waiting for her reply. As Santiago made his way to the bar, a young man in full-dress naval uniform wished him a pleasant evening. Santiago didn't stop, only nodded in passing. Hello, Grace said, smiling widely at the officer in an attempt to make up for Santiago's rudeness. It was Pedro Garcia, the bride's cousin, and the high school classmate of Bautista Larrea and Grace's older brother, Sebastian. When they were all younger, it seemed to Grace that Pedro was sometimes left behind by his peers, as if he wasn't quite quick enough to be in on their jokes or adopt the casual ease Bautista and Sebastian used when talking to girls or walking them home from school. However, the few times she had seen Pedro since he entered the Naval Academy, he appeared changed, more grown up, coming across now as self-possessed.
Always a delight to see you, Grace, Pedro said, returning the smile.
Lila returned to Santiago's side at the bar. She was less adept at maintaining her smile, and he could tell by her eyes that she was upset.
What's wrong, my darling? He asked. What now, is what he thought.
I got my period. Again, she murmured, dismayed. He encircled her with his arms.
Don't worry, Lila. It will all be fine. I promise you.
Santiago kissed her. When he looked over her head, he found Grace, watching them thoughtfully. A few weeks later, in a loud, brightly lit restaurant, similar to any Parisian brasserie along Boulevard du Montparnasse, Santiago and Lila were tucked into a corner booth eating dinner. Lila chewed on child-sized bites of steak, while Santiago swirled the wine in his glass, the meat on his plate untouched. He smoked a cigarette out of pure boredom. Lila didn't comment when the smoke floated over her way. They weren't speaking much to each other lately, which was perfectly fine with Santiago. When Santiago saw the maitre d' escort Valentina and Maximo to a table near the front, his chest tightened. Lila picked at her food, unaware. He stubbed out his cigarette and said,
I have to make a call.
He went toward them, without a plan or strategy. Valentina's head turned in his direction, and he ducked behind a column. A waiter asked if he needed anything. Feeling like he had been caught spying, a red-faced Santiago shook his head and switched directions. He walked toward the men's room, lighting another cigarette to calm himself down. It wasn't like Maximo to come to this type of restaurant. He glanced back at their table. They must be celebrating something. Their exchange was loose and intimate, very much like a couple in love. Chapter 33. August, 1998.
Señor Dario Zubieta?
Franco politely addressed the eye staring at him through a peephole. The information provided by the hospital worker Bettina, the morning after our visit to San Rafael Hospital, had brought us to Mataderos, a neighborhood on the outer reaches of the city. The eye blinked in response, and the peephole cover dropped back down. Bolts slid, chains unlatched, and the apartment door slowly opened.
Come in, please, said Dario,
a man whose face I could not fully see because of his stooped posture. A yellow Labrador barked excitedly, plopping his front paws on Franco's thighs. Franco smiled and grabbed at the fold of flesh on the dog's scruff.
People! Down! down,
ordered the hunched man with a stern tone. The dog dropped his paws and sniffed our feet.
Hey, people.
Franco kneeled and rubbed the dog behind its ears.
You're a good doggy, aren't you? I've been waiting for you, eh? Bettina told me you were going to come at 6 o'clock. It's after 7.
I know, my apologies. My class ran late,
Franco explained. We brought some baked goods for tea, I said, holding out a white cardboard box tied with a string. The name of Panaderia El Norte, the bakery across the street from Franco's building, was stamped in blue ink across the top. Dario lifted his head long enough to catch my eye.
Will you prepare us a pot of tea then, señorita?
He pointed to where the kitchen was, and I left the men. Earlier, when we went to Franco's local bakery to buy pastries for our visit to Mr. Subieta, Franco had insisted I sample some of his favorites.
The best in Buenos Aires, he claimed enthusiastically.
As we were waiting to be served, Franco told me about the Italian bakers who had migrated to Argentina at the beginning of the 20th century, many of them bringing along their anarchist ideas. A few popular pastries soon came to be known as Sacramentos, Vigilantes, Cañoncitos, names intended to ridicule the church, the government, and the military. Between the two of us, we must have eaten a dozen pastries. A few of them were sugary, or filled with dulce de leche, and Franco used his handkerchief to brush off the sugary crumbs from around my mouth. When he realized we were going to be late, the cashier sent us on our way with a,
"Pay me tomorrow, Franco."
As we ran to catch the bus, he took my hand in his, sending a warm, sensual current through me. I marveled at how, even as my world was flipping upside down, I had had the good fortune of meeting Franco Bonetti. A box of matches sat on the counter, and I lit the burner under the full kettle. After rinsing the cups and small plates, I arranged everything on a tray I had wiped with a dish towel. When the tea was ready, I joined them in the living room. The furniture was wrapped in clear plastic sheets, and a light film of furry gray dust covered the coffee and side tables. A potted plant in serious need of sunlight drooped in a corner. The room could have benefited from some fresh air, too, and I wondered when the curtains and windows had last been opened. Once Dario had a cup of milky tea and a sweet or two, he began to talk.
Bettina is a good woman. Hard to believe that, after all these years, she's still working at San Rafael Hospital.
Pipo was curled around the man's feet, and the dog's mouth opened instinctively just before his master would break off a piece of a cocktail-sized sandwich for him.
After my daughter was abducted, Bettina visited us every couple of weeks to check in, you see, to find out if we had received any news. She went grocery shopping for us a few times. My poor wife. It was tough on her.
The old man sneezed and Franco answered,
"Bless you."
"Thank you. These damn allergies."
Dario pulled out a handkerchief and wiped his nose.
"As I was saying, Bettina was good to us after our Elena went to a better place. You know, she still comes over from the hospital once in a while. But I tell her that I'm managing just fine. I've got people here."
"Did your daughter work with Bettina?"
Franco asked.
"They were in the same department, but Elena was a nurse. Obstetrics, you see. She loved babies."
Dario gestured toward the mantelpiece. On it was a photo of a young woman with a bright smile, crouched down, her arms around a Labrador retriever. A few small objects, including a bunch of pressed brown flowers, had been placed around the framed photo. From the fringed suede jacket and oversized yellow-tinted glasses she was wearing, I guessed the picture had to be at least 20 years old.
"She was a hard-working girl, our Elena. Didn't mind the hours. Not her. Her Basque jeans, you see."
The dog stretched its legs and meandered over to Franco.
"He likes you, young man," Dario observed. Where was I? Oh, yes. So she was working at San Rafael Hospital, and one day they switched her schedule to the night shift. She didn't complain. Not my daughter. She loved what she did. Her colleagues were like family to her. She was a happy girl.
He paused.
That was how it was, you see, until she started noticing that pregnant women were being brought in at night, alone, without their husbands or parents or siblings or even friends. They were always alone. In the morning, the mothers and babies would be gone. When she asked about it, she was hushed by one of her colleagues. She was told not to ask their superiors. She would only cause trouble, might possibly lose her job. No one at the hospital asked any questions. Everyone looked the other way. But she continued to hear and see things.
He signaled to the photo.
Will you bring it down for me?
I picked up the frame, wiped off the dust with my sleeve, and handed it to him. He gazed at his daughter's image while he continued his story.
One night, a young lady came in. She was in labor. When the doctor left the room to scrub up, the pregnant woman started crying. But not from pain, no sir. She was crying from fear. My daughter could hear the difference, you see. The woman motioned for Elena to come in closer. She needed to tell her something. The woman whispered into her ear that she had been kidnapped. My daughter's suspicions, all those months, were finally explained. She asked if Elena could contact her family. She gave Elena her parents' phone number, and then the doctor came back. When Elena went on her break at dawn, she called the woman's parents. She had memorized the number. Smart girl. The parents came as fast as they could, but the young lady was already gone. The baby, too.
Dario paused to look us in the eye, but his hunched back allowed him to raise his head only high enough to view our chins.
Elena was visibly upset when she came home from that shift, he continued. She didn't tell us why at first, but we knew things weren't right. My wife was worried sick. She kept telling me something was very wrong, convinced it had something to do with Elena's job. It was killing our daughter, my wife said. So I made a decision. I told Elena I would force her to quit if she didn't tell us what was going on. And she did. One morning,
he kissed the photo of his daughter's face.
A few days later, they came for her.
Pippo left Franco's side and nestled at his master's feet. Dario pulled out an old shoebox from under his armchair.
They killed my little girl. But they never knew about this.
He placed the box on the coffee table, lifted the lid, and proceeded to pull out various items. A rusty barrette, a tarnished wedding band, a stained espadrille, a pair of glasses, rosary beads, an ink pad. And then he retrieved a small stack of surgical masks. He took the top one and unfolded it to show the tiniest footprint imaginable.
After these poor women delivered their babies, Elena would take the little ones to be cleaned. When she was sure that she was alone with the baby, she would take a print of the foot with a small ink pad she had brought and kept hidden in her uniform.
We gaped at the mask, amazed by the perfect dark outline of the tiny foot, and the toes, mere black dots.
What a remarkable daughter you had. You must be proud of her,
Franco exclaimed.
May I?
Dario handed him the stack. After examining a few of them, Franco asked,
Have you shown these to anyone?
Dario shook his head.
I was afraid they would come for my wife next, so I hid the box. But it's been a few years since she's passed. When you said Bettina suggested I talk to you, I figured it might be time.
Would it be all right if we borrowed them?
Would you be so kind as to pour me more tea, young lady?
I prepared Dario another cup, adding milk and sugar. With a slight tremor in his hand, he drank, then eyed the items laid out on the coffee table.
I'm an old man. What good is this shoebox going to do me if it lives forever under a chair?
Chapter 34. March, 1976. Santiago stood at a window and peered into a room full of children seated at long tables, eating soup from colorful plastic bowls. Two little girls sat on either side of Valentina while she read to them. His knuckles rapped softly on the glass. When she lifted her head and saw him, she waved to one of the nuns and handed her the book. Then she looked at Santiago, pointing at the door. He waited for her by the main entrance, his body vibrating with anticipation. After kissing his cheek, Valentina steered him to the back. They sat underneath a large lemon tree that offered respite from the late summer sun. Valentina folded her hands on her lap as if in prayer. Those nuns have too much influence over her, Santiago thought. He hadn't seen her in 3 months, and her face had thinned. Dark circles under her eyes suggested she had not slept in days.
Thanks for coming.
Have you been thinking about us? Is that why you called?
He asked, hopeful she had changed her mind and was returning to him. Strands of hair, moist from the heat, clung to her throat. Santiago resisted the urge to peel them away. Valentina covered his hand with hers.
No, this isn't about us. I contacted you because of Maximo. If I had told you that over the phone, you might not have come. I'm worried about him.
Oh.
He's out most nights, late, even until early morning. Sometimes he doesn't come home, or he'll go away for a couple of days, God knows where. I don't think he realizes how dangerous it's become.
To keep his emotions under control, Santiago told himself that it was reasonable for Valentina to come to him. She knew of his family's connections to the military and other spheres of power and influence.
Have you talked to him about this?
He asked.
We don't say that much to each other. He doesn't want to tell me anything. To protect me, he says.
A nun shuffled past them, acknowledging Santiago with a curt nod. Valentina lowered her voice.
Remember Enrique?
Yes. I never thought much of him. Acted as if he was going to be the next Che Guevara. What a buffoon. Still can't believe Grace dated him.
He's missing.
What do you mean?
We think he's been kidnapped by the government. Maximo and Enrique used to spend time together, so I'm afraid Maximo will be next, she said,
her voice down to a whisper.
Would you talk to him? He trusts you.
Santiago couldn't decide if he was disappointed or relieved that Maximo had never suspected their affair. He stood up and took a few steps.
I don't know, Valentina.
I need him at home. I can't do this alone.
You can't do what alone?
He stopped pacing, waiting for her to go on.
I'm not as strong as I used to be. That's why I was hoping you could talk to him.
She briefly looked away.
We are getting married, and I want us to have a normal life.
I don't understand,
he whispered, his heart twisting inside. Valentina rose, her hands stretched out toward him as if to soften the blow.
I'm so sorry, Santiago. I hope you realize I never wanted to hurt you. You know that, right? I need your help. Please.
Never had he seen her this vulnerable. He touched her forehead with his lips. He loved her, but what he needed to do, he finally understood, was forgive Valentina. Forgive Maximo.
Don't worry, he said into her anguished eyes. I'll talk to him.
A giant wooden board, its surface entirely covered with meats, stood next to the outdoor grill. Santiago sipped a scotch and watched Sanchez season both sides of the various cuts of beef with rough salt crystals. The gaucho hovered over the enormous grill and monitored the glowing charcoal, wiping the sweat from his brow with a large cotton napkin tucked into his wide belt. Once the flames were tamed, Sanchez expertly draped the chorizos and morcillas, blood sausages, across the blackened grates. Splashing sounds drew Santiago's attention away from the grill. Lila was coming out of the swimming pool, adjusting her bikini bottom as she walked toward the house. Josefina, carrying a tray with empanadas, had informed Lila that guests had arrived.
You stay. I'll see to them, darling, Santiago said.
Maximo and Valentina were waiting inside the front entrance hall. Santiago had invited them to the ranch for the day. Grace and her new boyfriend, Isidoro, were coming out too. The pretext was to enjoy one of the final summer weekends in the company of old friends. Santiago's real intention was to speak to Maximo in private.
Thank you for inviting us, Valentina said. It's so kind of you to do this.
Not at all. It's great to see you both, he said with a polite smile. Yes, thank you, Maximo said. It's wonderful out here. So nice to escape Buenos Aires in this heat.
From Maximo's open and trusting face, Santiago knew he had no idea that this invitation had come from his visit with Valentina 2 weeks earlier. She was good at keeping secrets from the man she claimed to love, Santiago thought, not feeling one bit sorry for Maximo.
Join Lila by the pool. I'll be right out, he told them.
When Santiago returned to the picnic table, he put on a smile. Holding up a transistor radio, he said,
The Boca River soccer match is about to start, but we're out of batteries. I keep a radio in the car, Maximo said,
setting down the book he was reading, Rayuela by Julio Cortázar.
Fantastic,
Santiago said, waving him off.
You stay. I'll get it.
He walked around the side of the house. Maximo's white Dodge Polara was unlocked. He opened the glove compartment, when something sticking out from under the driver's seat caught his eye.
You won't know where to look.
Maximo was standing behind him.
What the hell are you doing with this?
Santiago climbed back out of the car, holding a small Beretta pistol in his hand.
It doesn't concern you, Maximo said, unfazed. I keep it just in case. What about Valentina? What about her? Damn it, Maximo! Who the hell do you think you are?
He grabbed Maximo by the arm and spoke to him in a slow growl, waving the heel of the gun in his left hand.
You idiot! If she ever gets hurt because of you, I'll kill you with my bare hands.
Maximo slipped out of his grasp and backed away. Santiago looked down and steadied himself. He placed the gun on the ground and kicked it toward Maximo.
Look at what happened to Enrique, Santiago said, clenching his jaw to keep from yelling. How did you hear?
Maximo asked, upset, looking away. But then he turned to Santiago with scorn.
I'm surprised you, of all people, would be concerned about him.
He calmly put the handgun back in the car, hiding it under the passenger seat this time.
Don't worry about Valentina. I'm not exposing her to anything. She's not in danger, he said, walking around the back of the car.
A small radio lay next to a canvas bag with beach towels and swimsuits. He put the radio inside the bag.
We forgot to grab our swim things, Maximo said,
and with one firm push, closed the trunk.
Che, Santi, don't look so serious.
Maximo offered him a conciliatory smile.
Someone like the Santiago I know and love. Come on, let's go. The match is about to start. I have a strong feeling Boca is going to win this time.
And, Without waiting for his host, Maximo headed back to the pool.
Chapter 35, August, 1998.
Are you sure we won't get into trouble?
Positive, Franco reassured me, and with the flick of the switch, the forensics lab flooded with light. In the center of the lab was a long table with two large desktop computers. Although the screens were turned off, they still cast an eerie green pallor. File cabinets had been stored underneath. Numerous shelves held small boxes of bones, each one labeled with a name, a date, and a place.
Franco, only for you would I come into work after hours, said a man as he walked in the room.
The round wall clock showed it was 10 past midnight.
Hey, Mariano, how's it going? You really want to know? I would be much happier if I were at home, cozying up with someone I love, Mariano said, as he placed his keys on a nearby shelf.
He gave Franco a kiss on each cheek.
I appreciate the favor. As I told you, we need to keep this to ourselves for now,
Franco reminded him.
Of course. So you must be the one we're trying to match.
Mariano, who looked to be in his early 30s, gave me the once-over. Franco waved me closer.
Paloma, this is Mariano Menendez.
Pleased to meet you, I said.
Pleasure's all mine.
His dark eyes radiated warmth under his bushy eyebrows.
All right then, let's have a look, shall we? What have you got for me?
I extracted a thick manila envelope from my bag. I opened it and pulled out the surgical masks. The moment we left Dario's apartment, Franco had wasted no time in arranging this covert meeting in the forensics lab where he apprenticed. Mariano scrutinized them.
Whoever did these knew what they were doing. They've stood the test of time.
He walked to the computers and flipped on several switches. After washing his hands at the sink, he retrieved latex gloves from a drawer. He pulled out a chair for me and positioned it next to the computer desk. I hesitated. What would Emily say if she could see me now, in this lab, surrounded by human bones and strange machines, about to run tests to see if some other woman was my biological mother? I took a deep breath and sat down.
Okay, now take off one of your shoes. Whichever one you prefer first. It doesn't matter. We're doing both,
he instructed me, fully immersed in his lab technician role. I bent down to remove one shoe, but a wave of dizziness made me sit up again. Bringing a hand to my forehead, I asked myself why I had let myself get talked into participating in this insane experiment.
Sorry, I murmured.
That's all right. Take your time.
I looked over to Franco. He gave me an encouraging nod. And a few deep breaths later, I was slipping out of my right sneaker and sock. Mariano placed his chair in front of mine. A large sheet of white paper was laid on the floor by my feet. He pressed a small roller onto a black ink pad and rolled it across the bottom of my foot. It felt cool and wet.
Stand up, but don't put your right foot down.
His fingers closed around my right ankle and guided my inked foot to the sheet of paper.
Put your weight down on it now.
His cheery disposition irked me, but I did as I was told.
Well done. Let's do the left foot now.
I was slow taking off my other shoe and sock. Mariano waited patiently, and when I was ready, we went through the same steps again.
That should do it,
Mariano returned from the sink with a damp cloth.
Use these to remove the ink, and then you can put your shoes back on.
During the next half hour, Mariano took the surgical masks with the baby footprints and scanned them on a large Xerox machine. He then began to upload them to the computer. Biting firmly on the inside of my cheek, I watched with apprehension. When the upload was complete, the screen split in two. My right footprint was on the left side. On the right, the first infant print began to materialize. When the comparison was complete, the computer indicated that it was not a match. My left footprint appeared for a comparison with the left print of the infant. It was not a match either. Then the computer produced the next infant print. My throat was suddenly parched. I went to the water cooler, pulled out a cone-shaped paper cup from the dispenser, filled it, and downed the water in two gulps. I glanced at Franco, who was staring at the computer screen over Mariano's shoulder. A result showing a match would upend my life in ways I couldn't even begin to fathom. My hands were clammy, and I wiped them on my jeans. There won't be a match. I knew my parents. They wouldn't have concealed it from me. My father wouldn't. Not him. And then I caught myself. I had recently learned that my father had been keeping a secret about his past. What if this was another secret? A secret of the worst kind. A secret that would reveal my life, as I understood it, to have been a lie. Frightened by this possibility, I found myself breathless with the urgent need to know, one way or the other. To calm myself down, I turned my attention to a large map of Argentina hanging on the far wall. Each province was shaded in a different color. The map was peppered with red and blue-colored pins. "What do these pins represent?" I asked.
"The red ones indicate excavated mass graves. The blue ones are probable sites," Mariano replied.
"There are hardly any red pins at all," I noted.
"The forensic archaeologists in charge haven't been able to get much funding for the exhumations," Mariano explained.
The computer made a slight pinging sound each time a new print materialized on the screen. My eyes went to the pins dotting the province of Buenos Aires. Most were clustered around the capital city. I began to count them, and, in doing so, kept my anxiety at bay.
"Paloma, you need to see this," Franco called out.
His voice distracted me, and I lost track of the last number. I'll have to start all over, I thought. My index finger was on a pin in the northern province of Salta when Franco was at my side, taking my hand and guiding me to the computer. The screen showed two baby prints. A tingling sensation spread across my arms and legs, as if a thousand bees were darting through my veins. The flashing letters swam before my eyes. Match. Positive.
"It could be some kind of mistake, right?" I said.
My eyes flitted between Franco and Mariano. I waited for both to agree, for one or the other to explain that errors happened all the time with this program, to suggest that they throw out the results and redo the test. They both looked at me and said nothing. Chapter 36, March through April, 1976.
"The armed forces have taken control of the Republic. With the help of God, we will achieve full national recovery."
Santiago sat at the counter of the Florida Garden Cafe with the other morning clientele. Everyone was listening to the radio broadcast on repeat with General Videla's speech to the nation. Shortly after 1 a.m. on March 24, the armed forces detained President Isabel Perón. She had lasted in office for less than 2 years. Following her arrest, she was flown to a remote estate in the Patagonian Andes, where she would remain in custody for an indeterminate period of time. Argentinians had thus woken up on a bright, warm weekday morning to find themselves under military rule. General Jorge Rafael Videla had led the military coup, along with Admiral Emilio Eduardo Macera and Brigadier General Orlando Ramón Agosti. The three made up the military junta that replaced Isabel. In 2 days, General Videla would officially become the nation's president. Even as Santiago digested the news, scanning the papers he had bought at the corner newsstand, he was thinking of the day ahead. If he hoped to get to the Tribunales courthouse for a scheduled hearing, he would have to hurry. Weaving through the mass of pedestrians down Florida Street, Santiago made good time, until he reached Avenida de Mayo. A military mobilization was in progress. Tanks churned down the avenue, along with armored combat vehicles, flanked by hundreds of soldiers clacking their boots in unison. People stood transfixed, making it impossible for Santiago to continue walking with any speed. He cursed under his breath, even though it occurred to him that it would hardly matter if he arrived on time. As he elbowed his way through the crowd, he caught sight of her from behind. As if she could feel his presence, Valentina turned her head. Their eyes locked. The ground shook as the marching band played a blaring national anthem. The noise was too much for him. He couldn't make out what she was saying, but by the look on her face, he knew she was scared. When he reached her, she clutched his arm.
"I'm dizzy. Get me out of here, please."
Santiago led her away from the crowds and into a café on a side street. Inside, it was as if the coup had never happened. They were enveloped in the aroma of coffee, the sounds of milk being frothed, and waiters calling out orders to the barista. He sat her at the first empty table he found.
"Waiter, bring her some water, quickly."
Santiago had not expected their paths to cross again after she and Máximo had come to El Pinar. When she had ended the affair at the plaza, in Constitución, she had asked him not to seek her out anymore, and he had respected her wishes. But here they were, meeting for the third time in 4 weeks. He studied her as she sipped from her glass. With each encounter, he observed, she seemed to change, to grow a little more unwell. When the waiter returned to take their order, he suggested she have some breakfast.
"I'm not hungry," she said.
They sat in silence. He finished his espresso in two sips and began rolling the sugar cube wrapper back and forth into a little tube.
"Go, Santiago. I'm feeling better, but I'm going to stay here a little longer."
"Where's Máximo?"
"He's away, but he'll be back soon," she answered vaguely.
Santiago felt torn about leaving her, until his rational voice reminded him he didn't have a place in her life anymore.
"Are you sure?" "I do need to get to the courthouse."
"Yes. Thank you."
His lips briefly brushed her cheek, and when he walked through the café doors, he did not look back. The Perón years, defined by the chaos of widespread terror, kidnappings, bombings, and dead bodies, were over. The image projected by the military junta was one of discipline, and the country seemed to let out a collective sigh of relief. Order, at last, would be restored. Valentina sat on the floor, in front of an architectural model of a house. Her thick, curly locks fell over her eyes as she delicately placed a finger on the model to adjust one of the walls. Beside her lay some plastic trees. She took one, glued the bottom, and added it to the row of trees in the miniature courtyard. The phone rang. She stood and wiped her hands on her hips, leaving traces of dust clinging to her white cotton dress. Feeling a cramp in her lower back, she applied pressure with her hand. She guessed she wouldn't be able to sit on the floor leaning over models for much longer. Moving her hair away from her face, she brought the receiver to her ear.
"Hello?"
"It's me."
"Hi,"
she said, sudden joy in her voice. It was Máximo.
"I'm so glad you called. I'm leaving soon for the daycare. You might have missed me."
"I can't talk long, but I wanted to check in. See how you are. How are you feeling?"
"Okay,"
she said, adjusting the hand on her lower back. This sort of discomfort was normal, the doctor had told her. No need to tell Máximo. She would buy a more comfortable chair as soon as she could afford one.
"Are you eating?"
he asked.
"Yes, I'm taking care of myself.
Are you?"
She heard his soft laughter.
"I am."
"I'll see you tonight, right?"
"That's what I'm calling you about. I can't."
"Why not? You said you'd only be gone for a day." It's been 3 days already.
A night, not long ago, after they made love, they found it hard to fall asleep. The sounds of a helicopter flying slowly in circles over their neighborhood disturbed the quiet of their bedroom, big enough to fit only the bed and an armoire that they shared. Valentina curled herself into his body, and he wrapped his arms around her. They lay like that for a while, and then she asked him to reconsider whatever it was that he was doing. Since the coup, he was spending even more time away than before.
It's dangerous. Too dangerous, she whispered,
her head on his chest. Enrique's disappearance in February had upset them both terribly. He was still missing, and Valentina had hoped it would bring an end to Maximo's activism. Maximo, her fiancé. Getting married had not been in her plans. The night she met Santiago, when he boldly announced to her that she would marry him, she had laughed at the idea. She had been only 21 at the time, still relatively new to the city, with her whole life ahead of her. 3 years later, she was marrying Maximo instead. She loved Maximo. But how had she ended up here? She knew, of course. It was just that she could not quite believe this was how their lives had turned out. Santiago with Lila, Valentina with Maximo. Maximo drew her head back to look at her.
It's more dangerous to sit around and do nothing, he said.
She admired his courage, but the danger was palpable, and it was closing in on them. And yet, Maximo had been clear in his intentions. He would not resign himself to what was happening in their country. It was not their first argument on this topic, but detecting a higher note of anxiety in her voice that night, he assured her that everything would soon return to normal. They could marry in Córdoba and stay there indefinitely, if she preferred. He had thinned, and the lines on his forehead had deepened. His energy, however, had doubled, and the moment she fell asleep, he would get up and move to the living room to smoke and think. He would sketch out ideas for a leaflet denouncing the dictatorship and the illegal detention of Argentine citizens. When ready and printed, the leaflet would be secretly disseminated throughout the city and country. It was the only way to work around the government's censorship and raise awareness. Valentina switched the phone to her other ear and asked,
"Where are you?"
"You know I can't tell you," he reminded her gently.
"Why not?"
She was tired of his evasiveness, the nights alone without him. Most of all, she was tired of living in a constant state of dread.
"I'm sorry, my dear."
They no longer called each other by their names on the phone. Maximo said more caution and care in all things were needed.
"I know this has been hard on you."
"When will you be back?"
"Soon."
He told her he loved her, and waited for her to say the same. But she wouldn't. Holding back was the only leverage she had left to shake some sense into him. Valentina replaced the receiver. Immediately regretting how the conversation had ended, she picked it back up again. More than once, he had told her she was the only reason he came home. She would tell him she loved him, and would not be at rest until he returned. But the line was dead, and she had no way to reach him. Maximo had called from a payphone. Fiddling with her stone pendant, she stared absentmindedly at the model. It was impossible to concentrate now. She sighed and rolled up the blueprints. The elevator had broken down again. She would have to take the stairs. When she reached the lobby, Jose, the building superintendent, met her outside his apartment door.
"Good afternoon, Miss Quintero. How are you?"
"Very well. And you?"
"Fine, thanks."
A little girl peeked from behind Jose's back. His daughter, Marcela.
"Marcelita! Come here. I have something for you."
Valentina opened her satchel and pulled out a doll-sized bed, complete with a painted headboard and a little pillow and quilt.
"Look what I made for you."
She placed the bed in Marcela's plump hands. The girl opened her eyes wide with amazement and hugged Valentina. The street was deserted. The black pavement glistened from the afternoon heat. She glanced at her watch. It was 3 p.m. If she caught the 3:30 train, she would make it just in time for her shift at Casa de los Niños. She gathered her hair with both hands and twisted it into a bun. A green Ford Falcon without license plates squealed to a stop beside her at an intersection. Valentina turned her head to glimpse the driver, who was staring straight ahead, when she felt a presence behind her. All of a sudden, she was pitched forward into blackness. In a brief moment of confusion, she believed it was someone she knew who had put their hands over her eyes and would soon lift them, exclaiming, "Surprise!" But then she felt the roughness of the fabric against her eyes and nose. Suffocating, she thrashed her arms, but there were two of them, and they easily forced her into the back of the car. The driver shifted gears, and with a rev of the engine, the car screeched away, creating a sound that might have alerted other pedestrians, except that no one was outside but the old flower woman, who was, for the most part, deaf. Had the woman looked down the street at that precise moment, she would have seen the Ford Falcon speeding through a red light. Chapter 37. August, 1998. It was impossible to sleep the night I found out Valentina was my mother. In shock and unable to think, I had Franco accompany me back to Abuelo's apartment from the forensics lab. Only after I reassured him that I was fine did he agree to leave. It was when he shut the door behind him and I found myself alone in the apartment that I began to shake uncontrollably. The news had turned me inside out. Later, when the sky began to slowly lighten with the approaching dawn, I remember picking up the phone to confront my parents. But each time I did, my stomach would twist with fear and nausea. Part of me hoped they would say the lab report was absurd, a hoax. A memory came rushing back. I was 12 years old, and I asked why there were no pictures of Mom pregnant with me. She told me she had looked so big that she hadn't let anyone photograph her. Apologizing for her foolish vanity, my mother hugged me, but I felt awful, responsible for her misshapen body. Now that I knew the truth, I couldn't bear them lying to me, as they had been doing, I realized at that moment, my whole life. I would need to recover my strength before speaking to them. After a fitful sleep, I called Franco. He didn't pick up, and I assumed he was in class. I calculated that by the time I walked to his apartment, he would be back from school. An hour or so later, I was on his block, and when I looked up to his apartment, I saw a figure move past his window. "Hope I'm not interrupting anything," I said when Franco opened the door. "Not at all. I was looking for an excuse to take a break." He was wearing an old black turtleneck and jeans. A pen was tucked behind his ear, and he held a textbook in his hand. "Come in." I stepped inside and he kissed my cheek. "I called your cell phone a little while ago. Wanted to make sure you're okay. Are you?"
"I'm fine."
Afraid my parents might call, I had turned my phone off. I wasn't ready to talk to either one of them.
"Really? I know it can't be easy."
His brow knitted with worry.
"I wish you had let me stay with you a little longer last night."
"I needed time by myself."
He put the kettle on.
"Can I make you a coffee or a tea?"
"A tea would be great, thanks."
I wandered over to his sofa, and he quietly went about the kitchen preparing our tea. He brought our cups to the sofa and sat beside me. We sipped in silence.
"Do you want to talk?"
Franco asked.
"I'd like to just sit here for a while, if that's okay. I didn't really sleep last night."
"Claro. I've got just the thing."
He sprang up and soon returned with a blanket and pillow from his bedroom. "It can get drafty in here with these old windows." He pointed across the apartment.
"I'll be studying over there."
Open books and loose-leaf papers covered the dining room table.
"Let me know if you need anything."
"Thank you."
He went to his desk, but after a moment,
I called his name. He turned, his kind eyes resting on my face. Surely he'd understand how hard the past 18 hours had been, how I no longer felt attached to the world I once belonged to. And maybe he'd relate to the grief that had seemed to carve out my stomach. I wanted to tell you that. My throat constricted, and I couldn't go on. If I did, I would start crying and not be able to stop.
What is it, Paloma? You can tell me.
To calm myself, I let out a slow exhale. I was just going to thank you. You've been a good friend. Ever since I arrived in Buenos Aires, it's like I've been living outside myself. As if everything that's been going on is happening to someone else and not me. In my mind, I had been playing a game, thinking that in the end, it wouldn't affect me. I feel so stupid. I hate myself for not knowing. I pressed my eyes with my wrists. I always felt ambivalent, you know, about who I was. I would tell myself that all kids go through the painful teen years, but I never imagined this, I said with a brittle laugh. I feel like I'm in free fall. Franco had returned to my side, and he caressed my cheek. He told me, just above a whisper,
you can fall into me. If you want, I'll catch you.
He dried my tear-streaked face with his handkerchief.
I feel terrible. I probably pushed you too hard. I wasn't thinking about how the results would affect you, personally. I'm sorry.
God. No, Franco. You have nothing to apologize for. I'm so glad you've been with me. Otherwise, I might not have been able to do it on my own. And as upset as I am, you were right. It's better to know. He held my hand, and right when I thought he might kiss me, he stood up, glancing at the books on the table. He asked,
can I get you anything else? Are you comfortable?
Very. Are you sure I'm not going to be a bother? It looks like you have a lot to study.
No bother at all. I'm happy you're here.
I watched him flip back and forth between the pages of various textbooks spread out before him. As he read and took notes, it was clear that Franco had a love of learning. I wanted to get up and do something easy and normal, offer to prepare another pot of tea, run out to get something for us to eat. But my body ached, and the cozy blanket was making me drowsy. My eyelids grew heavy. Amid the sounds of rustling papers, and the faint scent of Franco from the pillow behind my head, I fell asleep.
Where did you find these? Franco asked.
We were on a park bench in the Japanese gardens, in front of a lake surrounded by Asian flora interspersed with South American greenery. Across my lap, I had fanned out the photos that had fallen out of Martin Torres's book. I had spent the better part of the day sleeping on Franco's sofa and was waking up when Luis returned from work with a bag full of churros. We ate and drank mate, while Luis talked about his day on the movie set. I noticed he was more engaged, making small talk with me, and I guessed Franco had filled him in on my predicament. After